This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program, day two from Netroots Nation here in Chicago. And I got to tell you, again, every time I come to Chicago, I go, I really love this city. Reminds me a lot of Cleveland, same kind of Midwestern vibe, same kind of folks, sensibilities, common sense, and pizza. I guess, you know, that's when you think of Chicago, you think of wind, you think of pizza. Went to an incredible place last night. Thank you, Alyssa Miller and Miller Broadcasting for inviting us. And the whole clan showed up, my kids, my producer Brett, his kids, our engineer. We all had a wonderful meal. And that's part of this event. It's the networking. It's the meeting people. It's the idea of how are we going to make the future just a little bit better for everybody. That's the goal. A couple of thousand fire-breathing do-gooders, as I said yesterday on the program, figuring out, hey, how are we going to take our issue and move it forward while simultaneously, hopefully, this is what I'm hoping comes out of this, while simultaneously going, hey, how do we move forward with everyone? And today on the program, we're going to talk with Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison is supposed to stop by. We're going to have Allison Gill from MS Media. We're going to have some labor folks. We got a lot to get to. But I got emails last night from some of the folks we talked to yesterday. And, you know, the interview with Randy Weingarten was the one that got the most attention. You know, the idea that, you know, and look, she said, quite frankly, you know, we've got some things that we have to fix. The pandemic did indeed slow our kids learning. There's going to have to be a process on how we catch them up. And look, that was a common sense thing. And it was something that you had to know during the pandemic that was going to happen. And this is my problem with where the right is right now. The attempt to destroy public education, all the Moms for Misery groups who are out there going, we got to, whatever their pet education incorporation idea is what they're going, this is the silver bullet. And the idea is, no, there's no silver bullet. You got to go do the work. You know, I grew up at a time where you got to do the work. You know, there's no simple solution to this stuff. And it was good to hear Randy talk about that. Look, while all the attacks are going on, all the attempts to destroy public education are happening, while all of these moneyed interests are muddying the waters and doing what they're doing, it's good to know that she's going, look, we've got to have a way forward. All of this insanity, all this hair on fire, all this, oh my gosh, the kids are learning bad things. There have always been processes to deal with that. But if you listen to the right, you listen to some of these, it's not all the right, it's the kooks. At some point, we got to put the kooks aside. At some point, we got to say, no more kookery. Please sit down. You finished last in your class. You do your research by watching YouTube videos. Stop it. We're not going to have policy based on the dumb kid going, this is how it should have been. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, she's going to be moving forward and saying, look, we can fix this. The calming is what we need. It's one of the things I say about Biden, the fact that, you know, in this environment of everyone's all, you know, panties in a bunch, you got Biden who's just doing the job, just calm. And that's what I liked about what I heard from Randy Weingarten yesterday, that calming, that, you know, it's going to be okay. We're going to work through this. The adults in the room are going to move us in a direction that kooks aside, we're going to make things better. Our kids are going to be okay. We're going to get caught up. The future's going to be okay. We're going to do this. That's what we need. We don't need more book banning. We don't need more, tear down things. We don't need more of that. In fact, we need a lot less of it. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Allison Gill from MMS Media is going to be here to share some thoughts on the Trump indictments and maybe some thoughts on, you know, is he going to go to jail? Will we see a trial before? I'm kind of interested to find out what her thoughts are. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day municipal workers in Cleveland, Louisville, and Philadelphia walked off the job. That summer was rocked with public sector strikes, starting with a firefighter strike in Memphis. In Cleveland, municipal services came to a virtual halt as city workers honored a police work stoppage. In Louisville, firefighters walked off the job after the Kentucky Labor Relations Board found the city guilty of unfair labor practices. And in Philadelphia, 20,000 AFSCME members, including sanitation, highway, and health department workers, rejected a last-minute contract offer. They demanded wage increases. But they were also furious when the city announced it would have to lay off city workers to pay an arbitration award to the police. Sanitation strikes soon followed in New Orleans, San Antonio, Detroit, and Tuscaloosa. By the third week of July, transit workers in Washington, D.C. staged a wildcat strike, as did postal workers in California and New Jersey. Labor historian Joseph McCartan notes that public sector strikes peaked in 1975 and again in 1978. By the late 1970s, the volatile recipe of rising public sector union militancy, inflation, and anti-tax reform made public sector unions more vulnerable than at any other time. Suddenly, the union became a convenient scapegoat for public officials dealing with declining relative tax revenues, demands for improved public services, and taxpayer unrest. McCartan adds that by 1978, public employers came out swinging in labor disputes. Public sector unions would struggle to hold their own in an increasingly hostile environment as their ability to strike was being severely eroded. The backlash against public sector militancy set the stage for President Reagan's smashing of the PATCO Union just 3 years later.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been looking forward to this our entire time here at Netroots Nation. Again, this is like the 10th year we've done these. And, you know, my next guest, one of my favorite people. We've had her on the show a number of times. And just an incredible person. So happy to see that Netroots was smart enough to invite her to do a panel. And, well, a panel on indictments and Trump, and should be very interesting. And that's why I've asked Allison Gill to come sit with us. She's the executive director of MS Media. Also the host of Jack and the Daily Beans as well. Allison, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having. It's good to see you in person. We've never met in person. It's always been virtual since we've only talked since the pandemic.
Right, and then this is the great thing about this event. You know, I meet, you know, so many people I've known for years, and we've emailed and we've Twittered and we've done all this stuff, and finally get to put a face to somebody.
Yeah, it's nice. It's good to meet you.
You as well. And again, I appreciate you coming and sitting down and talking with us. What do you think of the big shindig?
Well, it's really crowded. I thought more crowded than I was expecting. So I think that's great. I am excited to meet everybody who's here and talk to a bunch of people. I'm going to talk to my feminist buzzkill folks and abortion access front here pretty soon. Liz Winstead, you know, co-founder of The Daily Show. She's going to be sitting right over there, and we're going to go chew it up a little bit. And, you know, I love being around a bunch of like-minded people. You know, I used to go to other political conventions, but you'd have to see Chris Christie and, you know, to get to the panel you wanted to go see. And here we don't have to deal with any of that.
Well, we get to see you on the panel. I mean, and that's, to me, that's worth the price of admission right there. So let's talk about your panel, because all front and center in the news, the indictments, and, you know, I got a bunch of people saying, Trump, we're going to get him this time. He's going to jail. And I'm a buzzkill. I've been saying, no, I don't think he's ever going to be behind bars. He may be found guilty, potentially. And I certainly don't think there's going to be a trial before the election. Not a lot of happy people on that side of that issue.
Well, I mean, you know, for one, going way back to the Mueller days, I hosted a podcast called Mueller, She Wrote. Everyone's like, we're going to get him. I'm like, no, we're not. There's a Office of Legal Counsel memo. Mueller is a conservative. They're not going to indict Trump. And Mueller's not a messiah. Like, let's not do that.
But everyone did. I mean, I remember the memes of him looking in a mirror and, you know, seems closer than he sees.
Well, that's
Mueller's
still fun.
Face. And, you know, I'm going, no.
Jokes are fun. But, you know, I was trying to give fair warning to everybody. But this time, like, I never said, it didn't happen until February of this year when I started saying, I think we're going to indict him. February of this year, I even created a whole account called Indictments Only, because every time I would put news out, I would inevitably get 100 replies saying, wake me up when there's indictments. So I created a whole account called Indictments Only on Twitter. All it does is tell you about indictments so you don't have to deal with the news and analysis. But they did. They indicted him down in Miami, and the Department of Justice just filed their opposition. Donald Trump wants to have the trial after the election, and the DOJ is opposing that. We'll see what Judge Aileen Cannon has to say about it. We know she was in Trump's pocket during those special master hearings that she eventually was completely humiliated about by the 11th Circuit. But, you know, we have to define justice for ourselves.
Right.
Because a lot of folks have said justice for me only is him being tackled in an orange jumpsuit and put in prison.
That's never happening. I think that's never happening.
Right. And so, but what's worse? I mean, for me, justice has always been indictments, because that's what we can control with our votes. Is we vote in a president. Excuse me. We vote in a president. They nominate an attorney general that hopefully is a law and order and a fair and just attorney general. And then we can investigate and indict. So for me, justice has always just been, as long as he's indicted, just let's indict him, because we can't control what a jury does.
No, and that's a huge, you know, historically, that's an enormous thing. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that he's being called out and this is being recognized. Look, I lived through the Reagan era.
Yeah.
You know, come on. He knew. There's no question he knew, and now we know he knew, but he was never held accountable. This is a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other element we have to think about, I know Lawrence O'Donnell has talked about this, is that every day is a nightmare living hell for Donald Trump. And every day from here on out will only be worse. He is going to be throwing millions and millions and millions of dollars at legal fees and lawyers. He's going to be indicted in Georgia, probably. He'll probably be indicted for January 6th. He's got the New York already. He's also potentially facing wire fraud for fraudulently fundraising. That could be an indictment. Truth Social is under federal criminal investigation for their SPAC DWAC deal. Five people have already been indicted in that. So for the rest of his life, every day sucks. And that is also kind of justice, you know?
That's an interesting way. He's in his own special kind of prison.
Look, I'm a woman. I am a sexual assault survivor in the military. I wasn't able to report because I was, you know, threatened. If I did, a bunch of bad things would happen. I never got to see justice. So I find justice, as a woman who has faced that, and as a lot of people who have faced injustices, find justice in other ways than just an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs in a prison cell. And so I think that that's probably where my perspective comes from. So I wouldn't expect everyone else to have the same perspective of what justice is. But to me, that's what it is. And so just the fact that his life sucks and every day is his worst day till he shuffles off this mortal coil, that I call it justice by proxy. It's sort of like when Harvey Weinstein was finally thrown in jail and then tried again, and that he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. That's not my rapist, but it is a
right
rapist. And so I take a little bit of that with me as a I guess justice by proxy is the best way to put it.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I personally would still like to see him in the orange jumpsuit.
He belongs in jail. He does belong in prison.
But the bigger conversation is, you know, there's a different justice system for rich people and poor people, for connected people and not and unconnected people. There's a different system, and I like the way you've put this. He's going to suffer a consequence. It may not be what would happen to us, mm-hmm. but it is a consequence.
Yeah,
and I can see that.
And a lot of people say, you know, the way that I see the two-tier system or sometimes three-tiered system of justice is that we should strive to treat everyone the way Donald Trump is being treated. We shouldn't want to treat Donald Trump the way we treat the person we treat the worst. We should want to elevate our justice system and everyone be equal and be given those sort of due processes and deference give our rich white criminals.
Given the fact that the FBI took almost a year of, you know, kid gloves and, oh, please, will you give us back all the stolen stuff that you admitted you stole? I mean, I think that's kind of an interesting take.
Well, they were also very, that Durham was investigating them for investigating Russia. The FBI, I think, was a little bit gun shy. And this isn't an excuse. I'm just saying that this might have had an impact on the FBI wanting to get into this in the first place. The FBI didn't want to execute a search warrant on Mar-a-Lago. The DOJ did. The FBI didn't want to serve search warrants on Representative Scott Perry and John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark. And they didn't want to get their emails. And they didn't want to do subpoenas for the people at the Willard on January 5th and January 6th. And the DOJ did. The DOJ, it's so much so that the DOJ said, fine, F you. We're going to go to the Inspector General and the Postal Inspector and get them to get Representative Scott Perry's phone and Eastman's phone and Clark's phone. That's why everyone was like, why is the Inspector General seizing their phones? I was like, that is pretty weird. I thought it was just maybe an insulative step. No, it's because the FBI refused to do it.
And that's the reason that you see the Jim Jordans of the world and all these people going after the FBI, to get them second-guessing and unwilling to do these things, isn't it?
Well, we're both mad at the FBI, but for different reasons. Yeah. I mean, when have you ever seen a Democrat jump into the rescue of the intelligence community?
Not me.
You know, so it's
we're
bananas.
In a weird world, aren't we?
It's really weird.
So how do we turn this around? How does this movie end?
Well,
there you go. I don't know.
Honestly, I think we're coming to an apex here. I think we're going to start seeing more indictments. I think that he will, in one or more jurisdictions, be convicted. And I think our best and one most wonderful chance is Georgia. Because if ever a Republican is elected to the presidency again, and by the way, that's our job. It's not Merrick Garland's job to save us.
Right.
It's our job to vote. But if a Republican ever ends up in the White House, they're just going to pardon him for these federal crimes, even if they get him for seditious conspiracy or inciting an insurrection or obstructing official proceeding.
And this is what I was going to ask you eventually. What if he wins? Does all that go away?
Does what go away?
All the federal indictments.
Absolutely. And any federal investigation. He'll stop it. He'll fire everybody. I mean, look what happened with Roger Stone and Manafort and Mike Flynn. They all got off scot-free.
So the case in Georgia, that's a state case.
Yep.
He can't wash that away.
Can't touch it. And if they put him in prison, there's really nothing he can do. And Georgia prisons are way worse than Club Fed. So, and you know, we've been, as Democrats and progressives, advocating for prison reform and fixing that, right? So it is kind of disheartening to hear Democrats like, throw him in Guantanamo and lock him up without bail. And I'm like, we've been advocating for a no-bail system as Democrats for our whole lives. What are you talking about? Well, not for him. And it's like, it blows my mind.
It's amazing when, you know, my My producer Brett always says, you want to look at, you know, tomorrow's oppressors, look at today's oppressed. You know, that fits right into that mold.
You
listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Allison Gill, executive director of MS Media and host of the Jack and the Daily Beans podcast. You can find that wherever you get your favorite podcast, or just MS Media.
MSW Media.
MSWmedia.com. Mm-hmm. We'll get links out on social media, how you can find that. But, you know, that thing with the prisons, it's interesting to me that you got all those people who got arrested on January's for their little walking between the ropes in a perfectly, you know, normal day in the Capitol on January 6th, how they're all whining and complaining how bad prison is. When they were, I guarantee they were the ones who were saying, it's Club Med. You know, they got pools and color TVs and, you know, all the three squares and a cot. And it's amazing to hear them kind of whine. You would think naturally conservatives would be going, hey, maybe it's now us going to jail. Maybe we could all come together for reform.
They are. They're having hearings about improving the conditions at the D.C. prison where the January 6th rioters are being held. And
see how that works?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Now that some of them are being held to account. But in Georgia, no one can pardon any crimes that he's convicted.
Not even the governor?
The governor doesn't even have pardon power. There's an appointed pardon board. The governor can make a recommendation, but that doesn't necessarily mean it'll be followed. And if it is still a Republican governor around that time, it could be Kemp, who is not known to be a friend of Donald Trump. I don't think it would be harder. Let's just say that. It would be less likely to get a pardon out of Georgia than we would out of a Republican president.
So, geez, you couldn't go to Netflix with this kind of scenario and say, I want to do a bad TV comedy and say the president's going to be indicted and convicted of a crime in a state while sitting in the Oval Office, and the state's going to go arrest him. Could that possibly happen?
Every day something happens where I'm like, I would get thrown out of a writer's room, which is good because I don't want to be a scab right now.
Right.
But I would be thrown out of a Hollywood writer's room. Every single day something happens where we're just like, you've got to be kidding me. There's no way I could write it. There's no way. And the fact that we've all been boiling frogs in this for the last 7 years, makes it like Trump is out on Truth Social saying that Hunter Biden should be put to death for having cocaine in the White House. Like,
and do we know it's his cocaine?
It's a dime bag of cocaine. I mean, maybe I'm the least prude amongst us, but like, it's like, I was a comedian for 10 years. Okay. I didn't partake, but it's not kilos, Junior. Good Lord, there's not people shooting smack up in the White House bathroom outside of the Oval.
So tell us what you really think now.
I'm just, you know how much Adderall was running around illegal? Now, people who are medically prescribed Adderall, I have very good friends who are. I very much support that. The illegal use of it was rampant in the Trump administration. If you've ever talked to Noel Castro, who used to work on The Apprentice with him. But anyway, that's just ridiculous. The point is that there's just so much that the current president's son, his opponent is saying the current president should be, the son should be put to death, executed on social media. And everyone's like, it's Tuesday.
And that's the thing, where the craziest stuff happens. It's Tuesday.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of it, right? That's the whole point of the fire hose of the S word, as it were, as Bannon would say. This is an old Goebbels trick.
Yeah.
You know.
So how do we undo this? Last line of questioning I've got for you. How do we move? I look at an event like this. You got a bunch of fire-breathing do-gooders coming together. How do we harness this, march it out in the streets, and ultimately get them the vote. Look, this is all great. I see a lot of young people really excited. Yeah, fired up. Hey, get them the ballot box and start voting the right way.
Yeah, vote. I mean, vote and bring someone with you. The best, I mean, I love text banking. I love phone banking. I love letter writing, postcard writing. The best and most effective way is to just grab your personal email list, talk to your family, ask them about their voting plans, give them a ride. That's the way we do it. Because politics, you know, as opposed to Reagan's trickle-down economics, politics is a trickle-up situation. We start locally. We start with our city council. Run for something. We start with our school boards, and it comes up from there to our state legislatures, our assemblies, our governors, and then up to the national level. We have to make that up and out, like they say.
There you go. Allison Gill, executive director of MS Media, also host of the Jack and the Daily Beans podcast. You get those where you find your favorite podcast. Allison, is fabulous finally meeting you in person, seeing you. Thanks for stopping by and sharing some thoughts with us.
So good to see you. Thanks.
You as well. Our good friend Allison Gill. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, as I've said earlier, I think during the Trump years, one of the services I think Donald Trump did for the country is point out just how important other elected offices are, like the attorney general position. I think they finally were coming around to it, which is why I'm so thrilled to see Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison sit down with us. For our folks listening on KTNF in Minneapolis, you've got to be thrilled to see Keith on the program. Hey, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's good to be here, man. And, great catching up on things. And so, and thank you for having a great program. I believe that more communication is the key to getting us on a path of democracy, and I mean small d.
Absolutely. Now, the thing is, you know, and I said this about Trump. You know, the one thing I got a lot of bad problems. The one good thing is I think what Republicans have done is made everyone more aware of how important other offices are. It's not just about president or senator.
Sure.
It's about all the way down the ticket.
You're right. Well, see, one example, as I remember, is that me and attorneys general, Democratic attorneys general, including Josh Shapiro, had to come together to sue the Postal Service because in the last election, Trump's guy was trying to throttle and squeeze out the Postal Service because he wanted to stop voting by mail.
No joy.
And so we came together and were able to do that. That helped a lot of people see that, hey, you know, AG is important. We also defended the Affordable Care Act for people who like having health care, and that's a good thing. And then just so many other things, including clean water, clean air. The AG job, I was in Congress for 12 years, left there because I thought that, you know, we have, you know, writing the laws is great. Enforcing the ones we have can be very important, too.
And it depends on the mindset. Look, you know, we talked to a guy who's running for prosecutor in Cleveland, and he said, look, I want to go after power.
Sure.
It's not about you know, just hammering, using the power as a hammer to go after the desperate and the people who are struggling, but we want to go after the powerful. And this is part of what the attorney general's office, I think, can be.
Yep.
You know, in our state, Josh Shapiro did a great job, you know, going after wage theft.
Yep.
You're doing the same thing now in Minnesota.
Same. Well, so here's the thing. When it comes to this issue of, say, crime, you know, obviously if one private citizen hurts another one, we are going to hold people accountable and get the truth out. But so often, crime is something that starts upstream. So take, for example, the crisis, and I believe it is a crisis, of the theft of Kia and Hyundai vehicles that do not have anti-theft equipment in them. That's a decision made in a corporate office that we're not going to put equipment in this car that 98% of all other cars have, because it's going to save us money, but the cost will be borne by society, where kids can look on YouTube or TikTok, figure out how to steal these cars, and now you have an epidemic of car theft all over the nation, complete with high-speed chases, deaths. Somebody said to me, why are you going after Kia and Hyundai? I said, well, wait a minute. You want me to arrest a 17-year-old joyrider? What about upstream? Same on the gun issue. We all know that people who shoot each other in our communities, you can't do that. You will be held accountable if you do. But what about the fact that we have, you know, manufacturers and sellers, retailers, who are selling to gun traffickers and guns that ended up on the streets?
It's not guns that kill people. It's not guns.
Yeah, you're right.
People kill people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the gun helps.
Well, you know what? I tell you, that's like saying, you know, you had dinner, but, you know, you didn't use a blender and you didn't use a knife to chop the vegetables. It was all just, vegetables getting themselves in a pot and mixing themselves up together. It is the instrumentality that makes and accelerates the lethality. And that is beyond our – I don't even debate that with people because that's obvious. You know, they want to get you into a distraction. But, look, guns are critical to the level of insecurity we have in our communities. We do have to have common sense gun rules on people. Background checks, 90% of Americans believe it. Even gun owners think it's right. You know, and I tell you, something about these red flag laws, they save lives too. Yeah. And, you know, having waiting periods makes a big difference. One of the leading causes of death by handgun is suicide. Now, suicide, as we know, is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Somebody going through despondency, if they got to wait 48 hours to get that gun, that might be the time they need to get the help that they need. And so normal gun rules make a lot of sense. Every other industrialized country has them, not us. But here's the key. Whenever there's a tragic mass shooting, people often are afraid, and they go out and do what?
Buy more guns. Huh? No.
And so for the gun manufacturer, great. The gun manufacturer says, oh, school shootings, arm the teachers. Guess what? That's another sale for them.
Yep.
It's not about the right to bear arms. It's the right to sell arms. That is what it's about. They're trafficking in death, murder, and mayhem, and they're wrong for doing it, and we're going to stop it.
So how do you hold them accountable?
I mean, we're suing companies right now. We're going to keep it up. They passed this law called Protecting the Right to Commercial Sales of Firearms, but PLACA doesn't protect them 100%. And so, like, there's a lot of guns out there that are just, you know, that are alleged to have defaults in their operation. Like the Sig Sauer P320 has been alleged to have fired all on its own, and gun owners are selling them. So this is in the holster going off. You mean we can't sue for a product defect? We should be able to, and people are. But then also, there are negligent sales, negligent entrustment, nuisance actions that can happen with regard to people who sell guns improperly. There's a lot we can do, and we got to do it because we got to save people's lives.
No, ultimately, this comes back down to, you know, to desperation and
yeah.
to you know, I want to live in a place where people are hopeful for the future.
Yes.
And aren't scared. Most of the people I know who have arsenals, they're afraid to walk around the corner.
It is a sign of fear. It's not a sign of manhood. And that's the other thing. A lot of these gun companies will have, take your man card back.
Yeah.
I'm like, no,
look,
dude.
I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland.
Sure.
I was the only white kid in an all-black neighborhood.
Right.
Never felt the need to have a gun.
Mm-mm.
Never. I now live in a very upper-middle-class white rural area. I've got three.
Right.
And I say this all the time, and my black friends, they laugh. White people scare me. Because there's this fear that we've got to arm up, and what the corporate controlled media has sold them is they've got to be afraid of XYZ.
Be afraid.
You name it. Today's outrage candy is what you need to be afraid of.
Yeah.
When the reality is, what we need to be afraid of is we're being robbed blind by corporate America.
Yeah.
Mass consolidation is screwing us at every turn.
Market concentration, big deal.
Big freaking deal.
State AGs are working on that. I want to let you know.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
Because this is a huge issue to me. Wage theft, a huge issue to me.
Yeah.
You know, all of the things around consumer protection.
Sure.
Huge issues. Because those affect our working people's lives.
Well, I tell you, you know, your state and mine have a lot in common in that we have strong dairy industries.
Right.
And being a small dairy producer is very, very difficult. People are getting pushed out. We've lost over 700 dairy farms in Minnesota in the last few years. And people are still, you know, the number of cows milked is not really changing that much. What's changing is who owns them.
Yep.
They're going into fewer and fewer hands. And it's kind of hard. I mean, look, if you have a small dairy farm, you probably have a job outside of that farm because you can't make it on what they're paying you, even though, you know,
I know lots of people who are in that situation.
Yeah, and so what if we had more? So the problem is, under Trump in particular, he had an ag secretary named Sonny Perdue who said, get big or get out. That's the opposite of what the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act require. Our antitrust laws don't say get big or get out. They say if you get big, we're going to chop you down.
And we need to be doing a lot more of that.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about tech.
Yeah.
You know, as much information as they're collecting on us.
And with
AI coming, I want people who are going to be attorneys generals. I want people in Congress
sure.
who have the vision of what what's coming and help protect from the dangers that are, and AI and robotics are coming.
Oh, they're coming and they're here. But see, here's the thing. Why are all these so-called capitalists against capitalism? I mean, they don't want free markets. It's the last thing. They want monopolistic control and oligopoly. So we've added more people to our antitrust team because we believe that having competitive markets lowers barriers to entry, allows people to get in them, lowers price, increases different sort of product offerings. But when you concentrate and let the big just get bigger, they lock everybody out, they buy up innovation and never let it hit the market. No. These are the fights we got to have.
Yeah, your handler's giving me the eye. I got to let you go here, but last question here at Netroots. You've been here over a number of years.
I love
Netroots. What do you think what's going on here, and what do you hope comes out of this?
Well, I can't claim to be an expert, but what I will say is that this is a premier gathering of people who love small d democracy, believe that we all that liberty and justice for all. These people believe in liberty and justice for all. We believe that this country is greater when everybody gets to participate in it, and that is what this Netroots embodies for me. So I come because I get inspired by people like you, Mr. Rick Smith.
The hope is they come out of this and they go vote.
Go vote, go get involved, go run for office, go start a radio program, do something. Don't sit on your butt. Get moving and get active, because our democracy, I believe, is under threat.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I say this all the time. Joe Walsh and I are friends because we want to save democracy.
Yeah.
We don't agree on anything else.
But, you know, that's enough.
That's enough. But, Keith, I appreciate you taking time for us. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
I'm your guy.
Thanks so much. Keith Ellison, Attorney General in Minnesota. Going to take a quick break. Right back here from Netroots Nation. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that would become known as the Great Upheaval, or the Great Uprising, which began in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Railroad workers were angry. They had seen their wages cut twice in 6 months by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The workers went on strike, refusing to let the trains move. 600 trains jammed the rail yard, and soon the strike spread to Baltimore. When the Maryland governor called out the National Guard, workers in the city rose up and attacked them. The guardsmen fired on the crowd, killing 10 people. The strike continued to spread to Pittsburgh, Chicago, and East St. Louis. More than 100,000 workers stopped working. This was not an organized strike by a central labor union, but rather a popular revolt by workers fed up with their wages and working conditions. Everywhere the workers went on strike, they were met with armed troops. Workers, police, and guardsmen were at battle. Workers tore up railroad tracks and burnt railroad buildings. The chairman of the Pennsylvania Railroad voiced his opinion that those on strike should be given, quote, a rifle diet for a few days and see how they like that kind of bread. In Chicago, thousands of workers clashed with police in what came to be known as the Battle of Viaduct. In all, more than 100 workers lost their lives across the country. The events of the summer of 1877 were a turning point in U.S. labor history. Industrialists became convinced that they needed an armed response to labor uprisings. The violence of 1877 forewarned the bloody conflict of labor versus capital that would continue over the decades to follow across the United States.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, small world, as we're here in Chicago covering Netroots Nation. You know, as a kid growing up in Cleveland, it seems like we find each other. And no matter where I go, there's somebody go, yeah, I live in Cleveland, or I lived in Cleveland. It's one of those good, it's those solidarity, camaraderie little things. But I like my hometown to do a little bit better. And you may remember not too long ago, we talked about the wage theft ordinance that the city passed. Also, the county went and did. Well, now you need somebody who's going to enforce it. And that's why when I came across Matthew Ahn, who is running for prosecutor in Cleveland, I said, you got to come on and talk to me about, hey, how are we going to enforce this wage theft thing and make workers' lives better? That's why I've asked Matthew to come sit down with us. Matthew is a law professor at Cleveland State University's law school, also running for prosecutor. Matthew, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So first question I ask every candidate, you know, what is it? Why? Why are you going to do this to yourself? Sounds like you got a good gig, law professor, life's good. Why are you going to throw yourself in the middle of this mess?
Oh, I've loved teaching over the last few years. I really got motivated to run just looking at the kinds of outcomes we were getting in the prosecutor's office in Cuyahoga County. I'll just give you two quick statistics. Cuyahoga County tries nearly as many children as adults as the rest of Ohio combined, and has actually led the entire nation in new death sentences over the last 5 years.
Wow. And why is that?
Those are things that are completely within the control of the head of the office. So if the incumbent did not want those things to happen, they wouldn't happen. And if I become the head prosecutor, they would not happen.
So how would you deal with, you know, the I know some people are going to go, well, you know, if you kill somebody, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. How do you deal with someone who's murdered someone? Do you pursue? I'm not a death penalty person, so you know, because I know that it's unequally applied. As someone who grew up in a housing project in Cleveland, I know how bad the justice system can be
yes.
to poor people, especially to minorities. But how would you handle that?
Well, the death penalty, as we know from research, that it is prone to error, prone to bias, doesn't actually work to reduce the murder rate, and is extremely expensive to implement because there are usually millions of dollars worth of court costs with the extra appeals and housing somebody on death row. And a lot of victims have actually said the process of those longer appeals is re-traumatizing to them. And so a sentence of, for example, life without parole, rather than death, actually provides more closure to a lot of folks.
Yeah. No, I've said from the beginning, I'm not a death penalty person. I don't believe in state-sponsored murder. I get vigilante justice on a certain level. You touch my kid. People react and get heated. I get that. But in the calm of a state trial, I don't know, just because of the unequal treatment, that's where I'm uncomfortable with it, and I think we should do away with it. So, you know, outside of that, are there other things? I mean, I started this on the wage front,
yes.
the wage theft front, and then we went really heavy. I thought we would get into the other stuff down the road, but for me, you know, prosecutors, attorneys generals, you know, these are people who are supposed to be helping working people.
Yes.
And this is, wage theft is one of those issues that I think is extremely important, especially in Cleveland, because they've done some really good work around creating an environment to hold people accountable.
Absolutely. And I was part of the Guardians for Fair Work coalition that got wage theft ordinances passed in the city of Cleveland and in Cuyahoga County more broadly as well. And it is something that falls within the jurisdiction of the prosecutor's office, but a lot of prosecutors' offices don't treat it like that. In Ohio, wage theft just it meets all of the elements of theft. And we should be treating it as such, given that I think it's about 75% of the sort of illegal transfers of wealth in this country are wage theft. It dwarfs all
right.
robbery,
yes.
larceny, everything else
all
combined.
The stick-up stuff, you know, all the stuff that we want maximum sentences for, gas station robberies, bank robberies, it dwarfs in comparison. But we never lock up the white criminals, the white collar, I meant to say white collar criminals, that slipped. Truth of the matter is the white collar criminals are probably usually white, but I'm not going to go there either. But we don't usually go after them. Corporate criminals never seem to get the justice that I want them to get because, well, again, unequal system.
Absolutely. And so I like to think about crime in two buckets, or two ends of a spectrum, rather. Crimes of desperation and crimes of power. And we tend to over-enforce any kind of crime of desperation and under-enforce any kind of crime of power. And workplace crimes or corporate crimes generally fall on that crimes of power end of the spectrum. And the prosecutor's office has a lot of power. And if it's used to enforce against those crimes of power, you know, we can create a more just, a more fair society for working folks and for everybody.
I got to tell you, I wish more people would explain that in those ways. Because, that's really important for people to understand. There is desperation, and I've talked around this a lot. Look, the person who stole food because they got to feed their kids, I don't really have a problem with. The people who are robbing us blind because they want more, another yacht, a third, fourth house, or whatever, I have serious problems with. But we always focus on that person who we see. We always focus on that person who might be behind us using the EBT card or something like that. And we're never focused on the real abuses.
And I think there's all sorts of follow-on effects to that as well. Because we don't talk about things like wage theft and other kinds of corporate crime, we haven't even gotten to this question of sort of corporate profits driving inflation, right? This is a conversation that I think a lot of people are just starting to have.
Oh no, day one.
I mean, not you specifically, but like a lot of folks who haven't put these pieces together yet, because we still haven't even talked about things like wage theft with a lot of folks who aren't as politically engaged as you or I. And I think there's all sorts of connections that we can make if we actually start to prosecute these kinds of crimes of power. Environmental dumping is another big one that, the vandalism statute in Ohio actually covers environmental dumping as a crime as well. That's another thing that, you know, hurts working folks, right? Folks who live in the areas where the air and the water is being polluted.
Right.
These are the kinds of things that the prosecutor's offices can go after and historically have not.
And being a prosecutor of a major city like Cleveland, mm-hmm. you could have some major power across the country. Because look, Cleveland, when I grew up in the 70s, was a major driver for the Clean Water and Clean Air Act.
Yes.
Again, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, Lake Erie was dead. You didn't swim in Lake Erie. No. It was horrible. The only fish you saw were floating sideways with one eye looking up at the sky, because everything was literally, because we had polluted it so bad. So talking about that as an environmental justice frame, but also just as, you know, a good citizenry, good governance, I think is really important as well.
Absolutely. And this is sort of, all of these things are somewhat connected, right? These corporate crimes such as wage theft, environmental crimes, these are all things that affect the public and
right.
working folks. And there is, I think, a lack of enforcement just generally, not just with crimes of power, but anything that affects public integrity and society as a whole. And so this is, I think, a really important thing for prosecutors to look at, is how do we actually sort of enforce and promote the public integrity of the powerful folks, whether that is public servants or elected officials, whether that is, right, corporations or corporate CEOs. These are the kinds of things that will actually lead to, you know, more just outcomes, better outcomes for working folks, and in the long term, less crime.
There you go. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Matthew Ahn. His website, matthew-ahn.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at his website. Maybe donate. I would love to have prosecutors who think the way you do. We've been trained to believe that prosecutors are all about just, you know, punitive stuff. We're going after the petty criminals, the people that we see, people who break windows or, you know, break into cars or whatever. And look, we need to enforce those. But there's a lot more that can and should be done to ensure that people are protected.
I think a lot of prosecutors see themselves as a hammer all the time. And it's important to be a hammer sometimes. But there are other tools in the toolbox.
Can you be a hammer?
Absolutely. As, you know, accountability is really important. But it can't be the only tool we use.
Because we're in Chicago, and look, Chicago's a lot like Cleveland. It's the reason I love Chicago so much. But we're told the frame that I get everywhere I go in, you know, rural communities, they look at Chicago, it's burning. You know, everyone, there's crime everywhere. Everyone's walking out of stores. Nobody obeys the law, and it's because of people like you who say, well, we're not going to prosecute things. Is that where we're at? Do you buy that frame? Do you see that actually happening?
Not at all. And I live in Cleveland proper. I live very close to downtown Cleveland. And, you know, I commute by bike. I don't even commute by car. And, you know, I certainly have witnessed crime. And there is crime that's out there, obviously. Right? It's not to say that there is no crime.
There always is going to be.
But, right, we have to make sure that we hold folks accountable, but also make sure that they don't come back into the system. And generally the way to do that is to think outside of just being a hammer. Right? There is some, perhaps, debt to society that somebody can pay, but we don't want to saddle them with debt forever.
Right. No. Look, we need more people who think this way. And again, I hope folks will check out Matthew-on.com. We'll get links out on social media. Matthew, I appreciate you taking some time. I wish you the best. I want to see my hometown do really well and lead the nation on something positive.
Absolutely. Thank you so much
for having
me.
Appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back here from Netroots Nation. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Chicago as we cover day two of the Netroots Nation powwow. Check out the website, netroots.org. We'll get links out on social media. But, you know, the thing that I love about here is the idea of voting. Everyone's got to get out and vote. You want to change things? You can come, you can protest, you can have all of these wonderful powwows. You get people all fired up, active, ready to go and do all that stuff. Not going to mean anything if you don't get to the ballot box and start throwing some of these bums out. And one of the places, you know, like in my state of Pennsylvania, when Josh Shapiro was the attorney general, went after the bad guys. And the idea of using our government to make lives better, kind of important. And the attorney general spot, one of those extremely important things. And look, the one thing that I've been saying for a long time, what Trump and conservatives have done made us learn about government. What it does, what it should be doing, and what we should want it to do. And that's why I'm sitting here with Elad Gross. He is a civil rights attorney, government transparent advocate, and also a leader in expanding civic engagement, but also candidate for attorney general in Missouri, the show me state. Elad, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, absolutely. No, thanks for having me. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, so walk me through. Why do you want to jump in the middle of any of this stuff? I ask, this is always the first question for people who become candidates. Why? Why do you want to do this to yourself?
Oh, man. I mean, it's a lot of work, absolutely. But I'm a lifelong Missourian. I love my state. And we've done some great things in Missouri. And I'm really excited about the opportunity we have from the Attorney General's office. So I'm a former employee there. I used to be an Assistant Attorney General of Missouri. Some of the proudest moments of my legal career have been representing the people of our state. And our current guy sucks. We got to get a new one. So I've been working real hard on that.
I got to be honest, a lot of your current guys suck.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you got Josh Hawley, horrible.
Yeah, not great.
You got Schmidt, horrible.
Yeah.
You got a lot of horrible in the show me state.
Yeah, we've taken a little turn.
You've shown us crazy.
Yeah, it's could be better. I mean, you know, right now we're going through a tough time as a state. I think there are folks who have taken power and have taken advantage of a lot of folks. They have sold a bill of goods that's not accurate at all. But we've been vote. I mean, when we go out to vote, Missourians are choosing, for example, to fight this right to work crap that is trying to be forced down our throats right now. We've expanded Medicaid. We've done all the things that we want to do, but unfortunately our government has been captured by people with interests outside of the people of Missouri right now.
No, and this is why, again, positions like attorney general are so important. And I guess the current guy is now going after Target because they're selling things that I guess I actually don't get that whole argument.
No.
I know it's about feeding outrage candy to the
right.
to the dim. I know it's getting them all bunched up in the panties and angry. But exactly what does it mean in the big picture?
Yeah, no, I mean, nothing. So what we have right now from our current attorney general, his name is Andrew Bailey. He thinks that he's got all the power in the world. So right now, he's exactly right. He's threatening to sue Target for selling Pride merchandise. He is threatening to sue schools that have any kind of scholarship programs for minority folks. He's doing this to private businesses, too. I mean, the guy is like anybody else in power who's not good at their job. They want to keep us divided so that way we're not looking at them and asking questions about what have you done for us. I mean, just yesterday, I was a little delayed getting here. I was supposed to be here yesterday, but we had a press conference on nuclear radioactive waste that's been concealed from the public in St. Louis since 1949. And other states where this has happened, guess who's right at the forefront of pushing for transparency, making sure that we have our rights protected? It's the Attorney General. This just happened in Washington State, and our Attorney General was nowhere to be found at this conference. He's had these records for a long time, and he's assigned one attorney from his office of 200 plus to investigate and look into it. I mean, he's not doing the actual job he's been chosen to do. He's not even elected. He's an appointed guy, just like so many of our other state officials. But he's not doing the job he's supposed to do, and he's trying to keep us divided so we're not asking those questions of him. What are we paying for?
Yeah, this is the thing that bothers me. You get people who are ideological hacks who get into these positions, and now we're going to go after the outrage of the day.
Yes.
You know, we're going to follow the talk radio model. We're going to make the attorney general go, and we're going to go after those people instead of doing what the job is supposed to do, which is protect the people. And again, I go back to the guy who was attorney general in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, mm-hmm. now our governor, fortunately.
Right.
But he went after making workers' lives better, going after misclassification, going after wage theft, going after things that are going to help working people. Look, I get going after corporate America.
Yeah.
But I don't over the product that they put on the I got a problem with that.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, right now, like I've been talking about wage theft. This is great. I mean, I've been talking about wage theft and obviously right to work. They're still trying to push in Missouri despite the votes that we've had on it already. But they're going after working people in Missouri. And one of the big proposals that I have is to start Missouri's first civil rights division in the history of our state. We don't have one. They'd probably have to sue themselves if they started one, and that's probably why we don't have one right now. But we need to protect folks in housing, folks from discrimination, folks on the job. And our attorney general's not interested in doing that. And when we talk about corporations and lawsuits there, I mean, we have massive privacy violations right now where folks are collecting huge amounts of data on us and not telling us. We have massive corporate consolidation and monopolies that are springing up. So that's screwing workers over, screwing consumers over too. And that's the office that's supposed to be dealing with that. We're supposed to be policing these people who have bad intentions and are exploiting our state. And instead, right now, there are a lot of out-of-state companies that are coming to Missouri to extract as much as they can from us. And they know that there's no attorney general there to stop them. It's very sad to see.
No, I'm glad you brought up the idea of taking on consolidation, because it's something that, for decades I've been screaming about. The monopolization of our economy is not good for working people.
Right.
But we get cheap stuff. No, you may get something cheap now, but you got crappy wages. You can't afford the cheap stuff.
Yes.
At some point, the question becomes, are you a worker first or a consumer first?
Right.
And we've been sold that we're all consumers.
Yes.
Only.
Yes.
And that's got to change, I think.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So I'm big in buying Made in America. Our campaign, obviously, is very big union production, too. But, yeah, you're totally right. I mean, we've cheapened the base of the United States, and that's why you see a lot of industrial production left our country. There's a lot of talk about offshoring this and outsourcing that instead of building it right here. And I think we have an opportunity, especially in Missouri. There are a lot of folks who support local production. We have a lot of areas for folks to produce things, and I think we need to make it easier, especially for small businesses, to get started and have support to do that, because we got a lot of space, we got a lot of opportunity in Missouri. We just have terrible leadership right now, and that's what's holding us back.
No, I mean, there's a lot of things. There's so much. And as I said at the beginning, the one thing that the Trump era has brought us is understanding that government is important, especially local government. offices like that, like attorney general or auditor general, or the treasurer.
Right.
Those positions that the left never cared about. You know, it's always the presidential or
yeah.
the big Senate races.
Yeah.
It's never the boring kind of what used to be thought of as, the row offices that, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
Those are the really important ones.
Yeah.
That's what affects your life every single day.
Yes, you're exactly right. And in many states, including Missouri, and I'm sure in Pennsylvania too, the attorney general is elected separately from the governor. So on the federal level, most people are, familiar with that. You've got a president, you have an executive branch, and the president is making appointments in that branch. In many of our states, that's not true. It is actually a divided executive. And that's because the checks and balances that we all learn about, they also apply within that executive branch too. So the attorney general, our current one, used to be the lawyer for the governor. He actually fought me in court on transparency. I've been protecting Missouri's Sunshine Law, and come to find out, he's been the guy fighting me this whole time, and now he's our attorney general in charge of enforcing that law.
Jeez, surprise!
How did that happen, But yeah, I mean, he's not supposed to be the attorney for the governor. He is supposed to be the attorney for the people of Missouri. That is his job, and he has chosen not to do it, and you're exactly right. There's a lot of powers, especially in the attorney general's office, that impact us nationwide, not just in Missouri. All these lawsuits we just saw, Missouri was on the one with debt relief. On so many of these situations, they're going to the United States Supreme Court, and we're making national policy from that. So it's definitely something that folks should be paying attention to. Whatever state you're in, these attorneys general are extremely important positions and impact all of us.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Elad Gross. He is a civil rights attorney, government transparency advocate, and leader in the civic engagement arena in Missouri. Check out his website, eladgross.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can find out about that. He is running for attorney general in the state of Missouri. And this is one of those things, and you hit on it here a second ago, that you sign on to lawsuits with other states.
Yeah.
You look at what the Republicans have done masterfully. A lot of the social issues, a lot of the transparency issues,
yeah.
they've banded together to shut down. This becomes one of those, I don't like red hat, blue hat so much.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This is one of those red hat, blue hat scenarios where you got people who are fighting for the people and people who are fighting against them. And sadly, as I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do, and look at what these attorney generals, like the ones in Texas and the one in Missouri, does.
Yeah.
To me, the proof's in the pudding.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had, he's now a U.S. senator, but Eric Schmidt was at the U.S. Supreme Court arguing that employers should be able to discriminate against workers. I mean, he literally he lost that case, thank goodness. But our current guy does he's got right on the same argument. It's really unfortunate to see. But, like I said, these are very important offices with national implications and all of these kinds of policies.
So we've established they're bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've established... Yeah. They're horrible for working people, and it fits my frame. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. How is Elad Gross better? How are you going to do better? What's that hill that you go, this is where I die on?
Yeah.
This is my issue.
Yeah, look, I think I think there are several. I think one is we got to get that office to function for the people again, right? I mean, right now I ask this all the time when I travel a lot around the state. And I ask, look, have you ever had a town hall with your attorney general? Has your attorney ever asked you what you want from your attorney? And nobody's ever had one. The guy doesn't do them. He doesn't care what your input is. He's getting his input from these massive donors who want him to do something for them and not for us. So I'm running for attorney general to sue a whole bunch of scammers, including those who are pretending to govern for us right now. And I think that once we bring accountability back to the state of Missouri, once we bring it back locally, regionally, wherever we can, I think we're going to start seeing folks who want to participate in our government, who understand that, oh, look, it matters that I vote. Like, these people are actually doing something for me. But I think it starts by bringing back accountability however we can. And that includes, unfortunately, prosecuting a lot of the corruption that's taken over our government in Missouri.
So when you're doing these and you're out there actually knocking on doors, kissing babies, doing all that stuff that politicians have to do.
Dogs, lots of dogs, yes.
Lots of dogs. Hopefully they're not taking any chunks out of you. What are people telling you? I mean, look at what the narrative is of our politics. And the sad reality is you know, we get this outrage candy view.
Yeah.
When you get down and you talk to people one-on-one, because look, you talk to groups of people, you're going to get groupthink. You talk to one-on-one people.
Yes.
They're going to tell you what's personal. So what do you see people, you know, focusing on individually?
Yeah, I think, look, there's quite a bit. I think we talked about some of the issues at the workplace. Everybody's working, right? And they're all experiencing these same kinds of things. But in addition to that, you know, I was in Farmington, Missouri, which is a very red area of our state, and I went to the Country Days Fair, so shout out to the Country Days folks. But when I did, I just, you know, talked to folks and said, what would you like your attorney general to do? And number one was sue the scammers who are calling me on the phone all the time. Please, can we start doing that? And we used to do that. We haven't done that in years from that office, but we used to do that all the time. Two was improve our mental health system. And we've seen in Missouri a lot of defunding of all of these public programs, education, health care, all of these things that they're breaking, and then they're saying, oh, it's broken, so we should totally get rid of it because
we broke it.
Yeah, exactly right.
I talk about this all the time. Republicans tell us that government doesn't work, shouldn't work,
right,
shouldn't do anything, shouldn't be allowed to do anything, and then they proceed to break things bad enough,
yes,
to go, see, look, we told you it wouldn't work.
Exactly right. Yeah, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now in Missouri. I mean, right now we're spending per student in Missouri less than we were 10 years ago. And they're saying it's a fully funded formula. It's not fully funded. They changed the formula to make sure they could spend less on our kids. And they're making local communities, especially poor ones, suffer because they can't make up the difference. So right now there's a big push in Missouri to privatize public education because they broke public education.
Yeah.
They're trying to break all of these systems so that then they can sell it off to, you know, Betsy DeVos and whatever other big donors they've got coming to the state. And it's just sad to see that we were a state that led on public education. We had the first public kindergarten in the country. We required space for public schools in each of our counties. We required funding for public libraries. Now they're trying to take away funding for libraries in our state. We were massive leaders in education and public services in so many levels, and they've destroyed it. They've ruined it because there are folks with a lot of money who are benefiting from that.
No, I mean,
not.
Conservative ideology, the whole, your war with Kansas, both you and Kansas lost.
Man.
I mean,
yeah, and then look at Kansas now. They're doing better than us. This is really sad for me to even say that. But, yeah, it's happening.
No, you guys lost that war. You know, how can we give more to the rich and more to the corporations?
Yeah.
And it screwed your kids and screwed your communities.
Yeah.
So the hope is that you turn that around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, the idea is, I think, look, when we're going to the polls and we're voting on issues, we're doing that in Missouri. And I think one of the big reasons, you know, I travel a lot to places where Democrats haven't gone in a long time, and they're not hearing a different perspective. So we're trying to get, I mean, right in your face and say, look, like, these folks are screwing you over. Here's how they're doing it. I've got the numbers. I've got all of this stuff. I'm going to tell you what I stand up for, and I really don't care what they have to say because they are lying to you.
I got to tell you, I like you.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate this. I mean,
not that it matters.
This has been good.
But I'm hoping that
come to Missouri. You know, we'll bring you in.
See, this is the kind of Democrats that need to to come forth and be willing to go into those spaces where you know people disagree with you. Look, I live in one of the reddest areas in the country. I started this program 18 years ago with that exact goal.
Yeah.
We've got to talk to people.
Yes.
Working people want the same things. Working families need the same things, whether you're in a rural or an urban, whether you're in the country somewhere, in the ghetto where I grew up. We want the same things. Good schools for our kids, safe neighborhoods, good jobs, opportunities. Those are what we demand.
Right.
And we're always divided over this nonsense stuff.
Yeah.
So we get back to those issues. We fight on those issues. And hopefully we change hearts and minds. And look, I traveled all across Iowa last year.
Uh-huh.
And every politician I talked to said, you know, talk radio radicalized this state. Mm. Iowa used to be a solid, moderate Democratic state.
Yeah.
And now it is rabidly Republican, rabidly insane, to where we're going to put kids back in slaughterhouses.
I saw, we're working on that too, apparently, now.
So we need folks like you who are going to go in there and say no. So I'm hoping the Show Me State shows me something. Alad Gross, I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thanks for having me.
I hope folks will check out the website, aladgross.org. We'll get links out on social media. Good luck, brother. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. What do you think of our time here at Netroots? You got something on your mind? rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day municipal workers in Cleveland, Louisville, and Philadelphia walked off the job. That summer was rocked with public sector strikes, starting with a firefighter strike in Memphis. In Cleveland, municipal services came to a virtual halt as city workers honored a police work stoppage. In Louisville, firefighters walked off the job after the Kentucky Labor Relations Board found the city guilty of unfair labor practices. And in Philadelphia, 20,000 AFSCME members, including sanitation, highway, and health department workers, rejected a last-minute contract offer. They demanded wage increases. But they were also furious when the city announced it would have to lay off city workers to pay an arbitration award to the police. Sanitation strikes soon followed in New Orleans, San Antonio, Detroit, and Tuscaloosa. By the third week of July, transit workers in Washington, D.C. staged a wildcat strike, as did postal workers in California and New Jersey. Labor historian Joseph McCartan notes that public sector strikes peaked in 1975 and again in 1978. By the late 1970s, the volatile recipe of rising public sector union militancy, inflation, and anti-tax reform made public sector unions more vulnerable than at any other time. Suddenly, the union became a convenient scapegoat for public officials dealing with declining relative tax revenues, demands for improved public services, and taxpayer unrest. McCartan adds that by 1978, public employers came out swinging in labor disputes. Public sector unions would struggle to hold their own in an increasingly hostile environment as their ability to strike was being severely eroded. The backlash against public sector militancy set the stage for President Reagan's smashing of the PATCO Union just 3 years later.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I like that guy. I do. I get a lot of fire, a lot of passion. And on the right path. I mean, ultimately, you want that attorney general position to be someone, you want that top cop, you want that people's lawyer to be someone who's looking out for working people. You want someone who's going to go after wage theft aggressively. You're going to want someone who's going to go after unsafe working conditions aggressively. You're going to want someone who's going to go after corporate America screwing over consumers. You're going to want that person on your side. And again, this is a, you know, I hate the red hat, blue hat, but in this world where, you know, we're this is where we are, the red hats attorney generals are on the wrong side of every issue, protecting corporate America, protecting, you know, the wealthy and the powerful against, well, we the rabble. And this is one of those things that voting, this is what makes voting so important. Because, you know, this office, I credit Trump and the Trump era with making us more aware of all of those offices and all of those levels of government that we never thought of, that most people forgot about. And what conservatives have done is they've made us keenly aware because, look, their think tanks, their moneyed interests figured out how to hijack our government while convincing us. And this is the brilliance of the Reagan era, convincing us that government's the problem, that government can't, shouldn't, or won't be able to do anything. You talk to the average person, and we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs. We hear the IRS, we foam at the mouth and get angry. Same thing about government. Our government, you know, I know we've been divorced from our government. It's always the government, those. It's us. We were the ones who were instrumental in creating what it is we're being trained to despise. And by voting for good people, people who want to do the right things, who want to use these offices to make people's lives better, who want to make the future better and, well, the now better, we might have a shot. And this is where, again, I give the right credit. This is where the left fell down on the job, maybe, you know, didn't pay attention. But this is where the right understood. I remember when Trump was running in 16, all of the people in line who were going, I don't care about Trump, I care about the Supreme Court. They knew instinctively that this is where the power lies.
They were being told by their talking heads, hey, this isn't about any of his flaws. This isn't about any of his bankruptcy. Forget all of that. The prize is the Supreme Court. The prize is all of the positions that he's going to appoint. The prize is the machinery of government that we've trained you to hate. These people hate it too. And these people are going to restrain and use it, you know, not to help you and certainly not to go after people who are harming you, but going to get the others. So I got to tell you, I'm glad to hear that someone like Elad's in the race. Elad Gross.org, the website, if you want to check that out. We need a lot more people at every level, from dog catcher all the way on up. We need more people who are going to throw their hat in the ring and be fire-breathing do-gooders who are going to go out there and fight the good fight. That's what we need. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Quick break, right back here from Netroots Nation. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So while we're here at Netroots Nation talking about, hey, how are we going to make the future better? How are we going to do things better? Investments, infrastructure, manufacturing, undoing the last 40 years of supply-side voodoo Reaganomics, actually doing some stuff to make lives better. And I got to tell you, as somebody who lives in a rural community, broadband, internet access, get us into the 21st century, or at least into the end of the 20th, maybe. That's all I'm asking for, and I don't think it's too much. But that's why I've asked Jeremiah Cleaver to come talk with us. He's the president of CWA Local 7603 out in Idaho. They're out actually doing the work of bringing broadband to places like where I live. Jeremiah, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's nice to meet you, Rick.
No, this is important stuff.
Yeah.
The fact that we're actually going to move the entire country into somewhere near the 21st century, I think is really important.
Oh, I agree. I grew up also in rural Idaho up in the mountains. It's 8 miles to the closest town from my house, you know, and this is something that's become an extreme passion of mine, is bringing that area to where people can live and work and function. Internet has become an essential utility for life and work.
No, and this is why I've always said I think it should be a utility, but that's a fight for another day, I'm sure. Yeah. But getting things wired up, I mean, this is like the electrification era of the Truman years.
Yeah.
That we're bringing this necessity to people's homes all across the country, regardless of where you live. You should have access to something that's going to bring you, like I said, into the 20th century or the 21st century or somewhere close. Mm-hmm.
No, and it's also, you know, in the state of Idaho, it's an extremely red state. And, you know, I've navigated and I've found these issues are a cross aisle issue. It's agreed on both sides.
No, I'm a Republican.
That's true.
I want dial up.
Yeah. No, that's.
Please bring AOL back.
The biggest thing I hear, the realtors at the state house in Idaho, is the very first question they get asked from someone looking to move into town or from out of state is, what kind of service can I get? Because they can't work or function unless they can get broadband. So it's hurting people on both sides of the aisle,
yeah.
You know, companies and labor and everybody not having this with the new telehealth issues and, you know, all the stuff that's out there. It just helps everybody function and live.
No, and look, yeah. I'm a huge supporter.
Yeah.
Have been a huge supporter. Had Donald Trump said this is what we were going to do, I just supported him.
Yeah.
Because it's a necessity. It's what we should have been doing. It should have been done years ago.
Yes.
I would have preferred it to be a utility and viewed a bit differently, but that's another thing. So the other part of this is not just bringing consumers and citizens into the 21st century, which I'm glad we're doing, but it's about the jobs that's being created. I mean, you guys, I know CWA represents a lot of Verizon workers, a lot of AT&T workers, a lot of people who are going to be doing this work, earning good wages, benefits, good working conditions. That's an important thing for our economy and for our country.
Oh, I agree. And I'm actually what they call Baby Bell. So my father had 34 years at the ILEC phone company. I've now got 25 years working for the ILEC, which is a pre-96 telephone company, the Bells. And my son is a he's 19. He's a fiber optic splicer also for a contract company right now. But there's a lot of work and there's a lot of jobs that are out there. The biggest issue I'm starting to see coming in is the lack of training, the lack of safety, you know, and people putting their lives in danger. Idaho had 4 people die in trench collapses last year. One of them was a 19-year-old kid that just got out of lineman school that leaned over in a 4-foot trench and it collapsed. These are all preventable, easily preventable things, and there's no reason for anyone to ever die doing their job.
No, and this is where, again, I keep coming back to, as a union guy, you know, you're trained to know what the dangers are.
Yes.
You're empowered to not put yourself in that dangerous position.
Yes.
So, you know, I get, you know, because I've had some people who say, well, the boss, you know, said, you know, I had to do it and, you know, gave me a bunch of pressure, you know, that kind of stuff. In a union environment, that's not how it is. You're empowered to say, I'm going to be safe because I want to go home to my family at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, and I push that even with my son. Everybody is, there's not a single paycheck anywhere. There's not an amount of money that's worth putting your life at risk and dying. Because, you know, in Idaho, we've got it put in that anyone takes federal money, they have to pay federal prevailing wages, Davis-Bacon. And I said, well, that's great, but it's not going to do them much good if they're all dead because they fall off of telephone poles or go into confined spaces and, you know, get asphyxiated or die. You know?
So Idaho hasn't destroyed prevailing wage yet?
We just put it in. We put it in the guidelines for anyone that takes any of the ARPA or CPF funds right now that if they take over $200,000, they have to pay federal prevailing wage, Davis-Bacon, for everybody from the company clear through the contractors.
That's outstanding.
Yes.
Because, again, you know, the kind of jobs that are being created, you want to make sure that they're actually supporting families. They're actually, you know, doing something to help local communities. Because I argue prevailing wage is really, while it does help the worker, it's really the community that benefits as a whole.
Yeah, and that's the state actually agreed that when we spoke, I said this money is not just to build the infrastructure. It's to build a trained workforce and to bring the wages and the money into Idaho. And it doesn't do any good if you give the money to the corporations and it leaves the state immediately.
No,
and
excellent so, point. You know, excellent point.
If you give it to the workers, they're going to spend it in their state, their towns. It's going to build up that economy where they're at.
No, and again, that's the argument I make all the time. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're at Jeremiah Cleaver. He's president of CWA Local 7603 out in Idaho. We're talking about bringing America into the 21st century, building broadband better. I guess that's kind of your tagline. We're going to bring people into the 21st century, kicking and screaming whether they want to or not.
Well, and building it better is the our concept is building it with a unified or union workforce where we are trained and we are trained to do it correctly. I'm sure every state, every area has seen it. Idaho went through it. We hired my company, hired a somewhat subpar contractor when they first started years ago. And they were there for about a year. And I spent almost 3 years following up and fixing everything they had touched.
And yeah.
The downside with fiber optic cable is there's a lot of times you can't just get in there and fix it. So now you're replacing entire sections of phone cable to be able to fix that splice that they messed up.
You need good qualified people, and you need people who are going to be trained. And this is an opportunity for unions like CWA to have apprenticeship programs, to bring people in, to train them the right way, not the, hey, let's get it done as quick as possible so we can cash the check, but actually doing the job right.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's something I've been working on in Idaho. You know, and I'm truly impressed. I've had a lot of support from other companies. They all have. There's a massive workforce shortage in the United States that we're going to run into, and people haven't really looked at that pitfall that's coming up. So I was talking to the commissioner in Idaho, or broadband manager is what they're calling them now. But I said, we've been pulling people from out of state to do a lot of this work when it comes up in the bigger projects. The problem is every state's getting this money.
Right.
So all that workers, all the workers, everyone we've been relying on pulling in, they're gone. And I said, you know, I believe Fierce Telecom did an article the other day or a couple months ago about the shortage of workforce. And it's a high-wage workforce. My son's a non-union splicer right now. He's trying to get on at the telco, but he's 19 years old and makes, I think, $32 an hour.
Wow.
You know, which for Idaho, that's a huge wage.
That is a huge wage. I got a kid. He's going to be 18 soon. Yeah. How do we get him into that? Because that's the future, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, I think you're about my age. I'm 56. We were told you got to go to college. You got to get a degree. The path to the middle class is put on a white shirt and a tie and try and get a corner office. and shuffle some paper and look busy kind of thing. That, you know, work was bad. You know, if you worked with your hand, you were a failure. Mm-hmm. I think we're now coming back around to the we need skilled craftspeople. Yeah. We need people who can, you know, take a piece of metal and turn it into something, a piece of wood that it can turn, or, you know, wires and put them together properly.
And I was lucky, I should say. I grew up in the hills on a hobby farm. My father worked at the telco, but my mother, she actually has her PhD in adult education and worked for the college system in Idaho for 20-plus years, you know, and did this stuff. And so they drove me in, and education was very important to my family. I started with my grandfather, never finished high school, and he worked in the sawmills his entire life. From 14, Claire Tell, he retired. But I drove into the only Catholic high school every day. It was an hour and 20-minute drive to go to school every day, each way. And I saw both sides, and I had the opportunities to have scholarships and go to college. I opted to go the route of my father, and in the end, I actually made more than my mother, who had her PhD, you know.
And that's a story that's got to be told repeatedly.
Yes.
Because the plumber that came to my house and just fixed the tank that we needed while I was gone, that wasn't cheap.
Yeah, no.
He did a really good day's work there and earned a good day's pay for it. And I think we've got to re-educate people in that view that, you know, there's nothing wrong with people who work for a living. We don't, if you took a shower at the end of the day, you're still as good as that other person.
Yeah, and almost every person I work with at the phone company and my work crew, I guess there's a handful of us, but they almost all have a higher education degree, but they opt to stay and work at the telephone company because they feel safe. They know that they can retire. They have a way to provide for their families at the end, you know, at the end of their career, you know. I'm 46 and I can retire in 5 years.
Wow. You know,
because I started when I was young. And I've got a full pension and a 401k, you know, and that stuff. And it's unheard of now, you know, in this day and age, even at a lot of other shops, to have a pension and a 401k. I go to do new hire classes and it blows me away. One of the first questions I ask is all the kids is, how many of you know the difference between a 401k and a pension? And I just get met with the deer in the headlight looks.
Well, isn't that the same?
Yeah. You know, they don't understand. I simplify it, and it's oversimplified. I say the pensions, they pay me not to come to work. A 401k is I save my own money so I don't come to work.
Right.
You know.
No, right. And we've got to educate young people on that. Because a lot of the jobs in manufacturing, a lot of the jobs in the skilled trades, they come with those things because the unions fight for them.
Yes.
And for me, you know, I think back to that, my grandparents' generation, mm-hmm. you know, who went off and fought fascism overseas only to come home and fight it on the shop floor. Mm-hmm. And ultimately built the most prosperous working class in history.
Yes.
That they were able to work their lives and live their lives out with dignity in retirement. And I think that's what we all want, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, and it gives you I tell people, the union's not just about a prevailing wage. That's or a living wage. That's a really important part. But I have the option and the ability to walk into my state director's office or any manager's office and say, this is not right.
And
we need to get this fixed. And I try to work with them hand in hand. You know, I tell them all the time, I have a lot of friends. I don't need new friends. The way this meeting goes was up to you, you know. But there's some issues. And it may be a gripe or it may be a grievance, but let's sit down and work this out so that we don't have further issues. And, you know, same goal in mind. Everyone's happier if you can work together and come to a resolution. You know, being in the union, it doesn't have to be a constant battle ramming your head in the wall, you know. They happen. You know, I work with the airports and different work groups, and I've had blow-ups, and even some of the managers that I consider to be friends, we understand it's going to be a blow-up, and we just don't take it personally because everyone has their own point of view. But I also tell them, you're not going to mess with my workers or their safety and, you know, put them in danger.
No, that we need, you know, that. We need people who are going to stand up for folks in the workplace. And again, I keep saying the way we move forward in this country, organize our workplaces.
Yeah.
I do want to get back to why we sat down originally, because this is great. I mean, this is important. But the broadband stuff. I mean, this is a big freaking deal.
It's in my opinion, this is one of the biggest things that's happened in this nation in generations. You know, and even the legislators in Idaho, they all say this is anyone that works on this at the state level, legislative wise, their name's going to be etched in the history of Idaho. and they don't want their name tied to something that's a piece of garbage.
Yep. No, you know? And I go, look, Biden did this. I think there should be a 20-foot statue at every one of these places going, I did that.
Yeah.
You know, like those idiots slapping that stuff on gas pumps. This is Biden's legacy.
Yeah. No, I went to Idaho City, which is a town way up in the mountains, and I grew up in Boise County, so it's been a little niche of mine that I feel for these people because I grew up in that area. And, you know, it's an hour drive north of Boise up in the mountains, a town, you know, maybe 1,000 people, and they're getting fiber optic to their homes. You know, they're going to have better service than the people that live in Boise, the capital now, because they're going to have 10 gig bidirectional.
Wow.
You know, and who would ever thought you're driving up there and most people live on dirt roads and they're going to have the ability to have 10 gigabyte up and down at their house because of these programs, you know, and
10 gigabyte.
Yeah, which... I always laugh.
Hold on. 10 gigabyte.
Lumen's new service that we're going to be offering is 10 gigabyte up and down.
And what's that going to cost?
$70 a month.
I'm moving to Idaho.
Yeah.
You know what? I get 1 gig. I got 1 gig.
Yeah.
1 gig. One. Mm-hmm. On the business side.
Yeah.
And $380 a month.
Wow. Lumen's new price structure with the ACP program, the Affordable Connectivity, is now, I was talking to Government Affairs, and they're offering anything 200 meg bidirectional below is $30 a month, and anything 200 bidirectional and up is $70 a month, flat. That's our price structure where I work now. And I think it's amazing they did that. So if you get the ACP program, you can have free service at 200 meg bidirectional that's provided by the federal government through the ACP program now.
So if you're low income, we're going to make sure that – you know, poor people get this too.
Yes. No.
Because I think that's even more important that we make sure that everyone gets it.
Everyone has access. The next issue I've been working on in Idaho is the education portion to make sure that people can have access and they know how to use it. And so I've been meeting with the libraries.
Good luck on that.
Yeah. No, and that's where it's funny. Everyone says, oh, maybe we could do some recorded training. I go, if they don't know how to turn the machine on, they can't get to the internet meetings.
So you say you're going to do it in libraries? Well, did you know there's a movement to close down all the libraries?
I do. There's a huge movement in Idaho to do censorship and do all this stuff. And, you know, I try to stay out of that because I get too many tasks going myself, you know, with being a I actually literally work as a line repairman 4 days a week, and I do union work 1 day a week usually. And work on all this other stuff, and I've been shifting more to have to take more time to do this. But the library things. My wife is a school teacher and works with at-risk kids.
Yeah,
and you know it's a big deal.
Well, good on you for the work that you do. I mean, it's so important that we get. I mean, this is historic. I mean, this is I go back to the Biden thing. This is a big freaking deal.
Yeah.
And you're right there on the front of it. Right. Folks wanted to get more information. Where would they go to find out more about what you do and more about the ACP program?
Well, and you can look up the Broadband Brigade. I wish I had a card. We have a pamphlet here, and we've got signatures we're raising to send to all the governors in every state and everything, but I'm not sure.
We'll get
one, and maybe you can post it. But that would take you to our petition and our sites. And then you can go to, I believe it was, I had a piece of paper also, the fcc.org/ACP, I believe is the website. And that's for the Affordable Connectivity Program that's out there also. And like I said, it's historic. There's money to help the people that are lower income and, you know, elderly. There's money, you know, Idaho is a huge refugee town. And a lot of those people don't speak English. There's assistance for them to get it, you know, interpreters and that stuff to help them. And I'm just flabbergasted with everything that's happened in the last few years. To go from the Trump era to where we are now is just amazing to me.
Again, I give Biden credit. Yeah. I wish he would take more of it, but I'm going to give it to him. So, but Jeremiah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Keep up the great work, and I hope we'll talk to you again real soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you for talking with me, sir.
Yep. Thanks so much, Jeremiah Cleaver. He's the president of CWA Local 7603 out in Idaho. I got to tell you, this, as I said, big, big freaking deal. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. How much do you pay for internet? I know I pay a lot. Would this be helpful? I can't wait. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that would become known as the Great Upheaval, or the Great Uprising, which began in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Railroad workers were angry. They had seen their wages cut twice in 6 months by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The workers went on strike, refusing to let the trains move. 600 trains jammed the rail yard, and soon the strike spread to Baltimore. When the Maryland governor called out the National Guard, workers in the city rose up and attacked them. The guardsmen fired on the crowd, killing 10 people. The strike continued to spread to Pittsburgh, Chicago, and East St. Louis. More than 100,000 workers stopped working. This was not an organized strike by a central labor union, but rather a popular revolt by workers fed up with their wages and working conditions. Everywhere the workers went on strike, they were met with armed troops. Workers, police, and guardsmen were at battle. Workers tore up railroad tracks and burnt railroad buildings. The chairman of the Pennsylvania Railroad voiced his opinion that those on strike should be given, quote, a rifle diet for a few days and see how they like that kind of bread. In Chicago, thousands of workers clashed with police in what came to be known as the Battle of Viaduct. In all, more than 100 workers lost their lives across the country. The events of the summer of 1877 were a turning point in U.S. labor history. Industrialists became convinced that they needed an armed response to labor uprisings. The violence of 1877 forewarned the bloody conflict of labor versus capital that would continue over the decades to follow across the United States.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com, as we wrap up our day two coverage of Netroots Nation. Hope you've enjoyed what we've brought forth so far. I've got to tell you, today, the interview with Keith Ellison, you know, has got me thinking, along with, you know, some of the other folks, the prosecutors. And I go back to what we talked about earlier, the idea that Trump did bring some awareness to lower offices. And I hope, you know, as we look around the exhibit hall here, you know, what used to be a lot of activist groups coming forward and doing displays, it's a lot of political, you know, machinery. It's the kind of stuff that the right built 30 years ago. But it's now talking about, hey, how do we win campaigns? How do we change things through politics? It's not just the activism for activism's sake. It's, you know, how do we stay politically involved? And I go back to, you know, probably 20 years ago, I was arguing with labor leaders back then going, you know, why is it we ramp up 2 months before an election? And it's, you know, labor, you know, 2020 or labor 2022, or, and you have this kind of this growth and this activism and this stuff going on just before election, two months, three, maybe. Whereas the right has been doing this stuff 24/7, 365, year after year. It's a constant campaign. And I'm seeing that finally, you know, the left is finally picking up on that, that it is. It's all about constant engagement. It's all about constant information, constantly, you know, getting out and talking with people. And look, I'm hopeful where we're heading is going to bear fruit, because, you know, as we talked earlier with Keith Ellison, the Attorney General from Minnesota, there are lower offices that mean things. And that's the one thing, again, I give Donald Trump credit for. The right had been building that for years. The right had been building on this idea that, you know, we're gonna make government the enemy, but we're going to take it over. And we're going to run it our way. And their way has been enrich the handful, give more power to corporations, and, well, screw the people on the bottom. And the people in this room and people who have come to this
this conference, they're the ones at the bottom of the hill. And they've had enough. You know, so in talking with Keith Ellison, and look, if we had attorney generals in every state that were willing to take on the Federal Trade Commission and fight every single move towards consolidation and monopoly, if we had attorneys generals who were out there saying, you know what, we're going to go after the powerful, we're going to go after the wage thieves, we're going to go after the people who are cheating on, you name it, you know, unemployment, workers' comp, you know, taxes. I mean, if we had those kind of fire-breathing do-gooders in those kind of offices, maybe we're a different place. Maybe the anger isn't what it is right now. Maybe the idea that we can work hard, play by the rules to get ahead, maybe that becomes the way forward. And, you know, in talking with Keith Ellison and, you know, some of the other folks who are running for office, this idea that we can use government to make lives better is not a new idea, but it's a new era for that idea. My grandparents' generation believed it. We can too. The idea that we use government procurement to ensure that we get good jobs, that we get positive outcomes, that we get the investments that we need. And look, we talked with, you know, someone who's saying, look, you know, we're gonna bring broadband to rural Idaho. And we're going to get those people in rural Idaho better bandwidth, better speeds than I can pay hundreds of dollars for. To me, that is a way forward. It is great investments. It's well worth pursuing. So maybe something we should do. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you miss any of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you find your favorite podcasts. You'll find. We'll see you back here next time, back from Netroots Nation. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.